We're talking today about the book Malcolm X, A Life of Reinvention, the new biography of Malcolm X that historian Manning Marable worked on for over 20 years. And Professor Marable, whom we were going to interview on this show, died a few days before the publication of this book last year. So today we're talking to the editors of the book, Wendy Wolfe and Kevin Doughton. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thanks very much for having us here.
Thank you.
So let's just talk for a moment before we get into the meat and potatoes of the Malcolm X story about the writing of this biography. Manning Marable was able to bring some sources and new information to this book that nobody had ever gotten access to before. Tell us about that.
Sure. The project, as you mentioned, it was in process for over two decades, and it really did take that time. The resources that Manning turned to and unearthed in putting it together include everything from countless freedom of information requests to cultivating people who knew Malcolm, who had not spoken on the record about Malcolm. He convinced Louis Farrakhan, who was Malcolm's protege in the Nation of Islam, to go on record in a long interview. The fruits of that are in the book. It really is just a fantastic triumph of research and synthesis of that research in a very readable way.
The greatest source, of course, is the autobiography of Malcolm X, written by Alex Haley and told to Alex Haley by Malcolm X. And that also, I mean, tells some of the story and was one of the influential books in my life and probably in so many people's lives, but it also has inaccuracies. What are some examples?
Well, I would say that it's not the greatest source, but it's the inspiring document from which the biography springs.
Yeah.
Because it was Manning's work with the autobiography, teaching it in one of his courses and mapping it out against both the facts that he knew about Malcolm's life and the things that were left out of the autobiography about the later episodes in Malcolm's life that began to tickle Manning's intellectual imagination and saying, where did this book really fit into Malcolm's life and what can we really make of it? And so this is what began the researching. There are a number of things that are rearranged or exaggerated in the book, but the most important is that Malcolm, when he began writing the autobiography with Alex Haley, wanted to use it as an opportunity to make it a conversion memoir, to say, I was saved by the Nation of Islam, and I was saved from my life of sin, basically, and to show himself to be a very, very bad man. And in fact, he was converted in prison by his brother, who'd already joined the Nation of Islam, but he was in prison as a kind of a petty criminal and a petty thug. He wasn't the major player, master criminal that he liked to imagine, or he thought it was more important to portray himself as in order to make his conversion more dramatic. So you start with a less dramatic juxtaposition, and that's where the book begins. Kevin can talk a little bit about what is left out at the end of the book.
Sure. It's one of the things that's interesting is that Malcolm makes almost no mention of what were some of the most interesting and momentous times for him out of the country. And basically, that is in 1964, after his falling out with the Nation of Islam and after his Hajj. Malcolm spent most of the second half of 1964 out of the country, traveling in the Middle East and Africa. One of the reasons he was there was because he had hit upon or been developing an idea of taking the civil rights question in the United States and turning it into a human rights question. And part of this was to sort of bring the issue before the United Nations and to try to get some countries to pass a resolution about it. And to this end, he traveled throughout the Middle East and Africa for months at the last half of 1964. He met heads of state and was treated as a kind of American diplomat in many countries and was greeted as a hero in most of these places as well. However, Malcolm didn't mention any of this
in the autobiography.
Interesting.
He merely said I was out of the country, or he sort of just elides it very quickly. But this is a hugely important time for him, not just in developing his ideas of the connections between African Americans and Africans, but in the development of his ideas about global Islam. Very important time, but really never got the chance to unpack it with Alex Haley, so it's not in the book.
Extraordinary. Let's get back to that in a little bit, but let's talk for a moment about some of the major events in Malcolm X's life. He was born, Malcolm Little, into a family that were the followers of Marcus Garvey, who taught black nationalism, as did Malcolm's father, and they were the targets of racial violence, his family. Tell us a little bit about his parents, his family, and his upbringing.
His parents had met and sort of traveled north, had bounced around to a few different cities working for Garvey. I believe they ended up out in Omaha for a while, and then they sort of found white attitudes there just not just too
welcoming.
A little too much, and ended up outside of Lansing. Malcolm accompanied his father to speeches as a young boy. His father was charismatic, I think, in a way that we see that Malcolm is charismatic. I think you could. It suggested that the seeds of that come from his father. His mother was supportive, but also mentally unstable, and ended up being hospitalized and institutionalized later in her life. Malcolm himself, though he was an incredibly good student, ultimately acted out in class and never set foot in a classroom after the age of 14. So he had a very mostly poor and difficult upbringing in a lot of ways, but one that family became very important to him, and you can see the threads of that family being important to him throughout his life.
And then his father is killed in a suspicious automobile accident, probably run down, probably because of his political activities and his political persuasions when Malcolm is 12, so he goes to live with his sister.
And the life that Malcolm lived and that his family lived, I mean, having his house burned down with the family in it, because they had the audacity to move into a neighborhood where there were white people living there, even having their dog shot because they just didn't want this family to have a dog. I mean, it was a childhood with more than enough violence in it that reading about it, you kind of say, you know, if I were Malcolm, I would have had the same response that he did, namely, I'm not going to turn the other cheek.
Right. I'm not sure we can make a one-to-one correlation between the violence that Malcolm experienced and what people say he espoused, because he didn't actually espouse violence. He simply said violence was coming. What I think the book demonstrates so vividly is that these were very violent times. And these were times in the 50s. This is the reality of urban America and the reality of black America in the 50s and 60s, that it was a dangerous, frightening, very, very dark time, and with not a lot of hope. And what Malcolm drew out of that was a very pragmatic, somewhat pessimistic attitude towards America and towards the institutional forces in America, which were predominantly white.
Which he felt were arrayed against.
And arrayed against blacks. And it was certainly true in his own personal experience, and it was true in the experience of the people that he knew and that he grew up with and among whom he traveled.
The book's subtitle is A Life of Reinvention. What was his first reinvention?
Well, his first reinvention was probably as Detroit Red, when he moved to Boston
to live with his sister.
And I think he was 16 years old. He was very young, and this is where he fell into I think the city life for the first time, and there certainly was some petty crime involved in that, and I think he was a bit of a hustler and certainly imagined himself a bit of a hustler, but it was this sort of zoot-suited, colorful figure who, you know, portrayed himself as a big spender and someone who was living that romantic life of crime in a way. I think that's really his first reinvention. And what's interesting is that when you look at that reinvention, in the way that it fits into sort of the idea of what, for instance, zoot suiters signified at that time in the 40s, and what, you know, all of Malcolm's reinventions are really interesting because they sort of like connect up with these cultural touchstones and moments in the history where you realize that he was an actor, but also a player in certain ways.
And in many ways, a kind of cipher for the times.
Yeah.
I mean, that was one of Manning and our great goals in the book, was to really write the story of the times as well as the story of Malcolm X. And he touches on these eras in black cultural history. And, you know, he is involved in jazz. He rides the railroads. He's he gets a job on the railroads. It was one of the great employments.
He avoids the draft, or
he
fakes being insane to avoid the draft. I mean, there's a lot that's sort of wrapped up in what seems to be like a very sort of simple portrayal or character that he's living.
Yeah, it's a great portrait of Harlem, and also of the economic inequality and poverty that was happening in the midst of a tremendous economic boom in the United States.
These were boom times. This was the post-war boom, and it wasn't being experienced by the black population, hardly at all. And I think that's one of the things that set Malcolm on fire when he started to step into a role of political activism and to start to speak for the black community.
So Malcolm ended up in jail. He was into petty crime and not so petty crime. And then in jail, he came across, as you said, the work of Elijah Muhammad through his family, the Nation of Islam. What was the appeal of the man, Elijah Muhammad, and the religion for Malcolm at that time in his life?
It offered Malcolm a couple of things. It offered him a kind of discipline that his life lacked. It was a very rigid lifestyle. It was a very controlled, orderly, ruled lifestyle. And it must have appealed to a kid whose life had been very scattered and very fragmented, but who also was highly intelligent, despite the fact that he left school at 14. He yearned for knowledge and for structure, and that was offered. It also offered him, in the person of Elijah Muhammad, an obvious father figure who he responded to very emotionally and who responded to him. I mean, they became quite close. He was his great protege, and that delivered to Malcolm something emotional, something very strong.
I would add two other things. I think it reconnected him with the Garveyite roots of his parents. I think this was an organization that was espousing a very pro-black philosophy, a very positive philosophy. And I think that's something that appealed to him, especially having been through. I think he was really knocked around, is the sense that you get from looking at everything that's in this biography and the autobiography, by his time as a criminal, by his time in Boston, by his time riding the railroads. I think that there was a degrading element of that for him, and I think that the philosophy of the Nation of Islam was restorative in some way. And I think the other thing is that it was something to connect him with his family. His whole family converted before him, and I think it was a way of him in prison to be connected and stay in touch with them.
Tell us more about the philosophy of the Nation of Islam.
Well, it was a separatist philosophy. It had its roots in Garveyism. It had its own eccentric ideology.
Cosmology.
Cosmology.
As well.
It starting from the kind of the mystical experiences of
Wallace Farad Muhammad.
Yeah. And so it was a very, very unconventional take on Orthodox Islam with a different set of books and a different set of rules. I think it would be unrecognizable to someone who only understood African Islam.
Practiced Orthodox Islam.
Yeah.
And over the years, Malcolm fielded many letters, many questions, spent a lot of time as the Nation of Islam moved closer toward Orthodox Islam. This is something that that certainly fascinated Malcolm from the time in 1959, I believe, when he made his first trip to the Middle East.
There was also a kind of economic self-sufficiency in the whole thing, and that was a big part of what people practiced when they joined the Nation of Islam.
That's a huge component of it. First of all, drawing on the same Garveyite principles of separatism, it was a philosophy of self-sufficiency that the black community could not count on the white community for anything. They couldn't count on them for money, they couldn't count on them for jobs, they couldn't count on them for schools, and they had to establish a separate, complete life for themselves. At some points, they even discussed literally a separate territory, sort of almost seceding from the Union, as it were. This was something that Malcolm proposed for a very long time. They demanded a great deal from their adherents. They were required to tithe. A lot of people gave a lot of money to the nation. It's not clear where all that money went. Certainly didn't go to Malcolm.
No, they preached values of thrift, clean living. Mm-hmm. You could be the penalties for something as basic as getting caught smoking a cigarette were draconian by any measure. But It was. It was both an economic and a cultural lifestyle that was very focused on the community.
As I was reading it, I couldn't help wondering whether that played into the kind of white separate but equal ideology.
Could you elaborate that just a little bit?
So they're saying, we want to be separate, and white people saying, great, let them be separate, which, of course, separate but equal is a hypocrisy.
Well, that's what led the Nation of Islam into those very difficult entanglements with the American Nazi Party and the Ku Klux Klan, both of which Malcolm was, I don't think, particularly enthusiastic about when they was actually happening, and which he came to regret significantly later in his life.
So what happened when Malcolm X got out of jail? I guess he took the X at a certain point, and he was really transformed. He went from being a kind of womanizing petty criminal to an incredibly disciplined member of this organization.
He went back to Michigan, and he rose in the organization very quickly. And he was, over the course of the next few years, sent to various cities to be involved in Nation of Islam activities there. He founded temples, later called mosques, in some cities. He was responsible for selecting overseers and officers of others. He had a tremendous impact in the decade after he got out of prison in building the Nation of Islam. He was a fabulous recruiter, although the fiery oratory and his personal charm and charisma drew thousands, if not tens of thousands, of people to the Nation of Islam. It is under the sort of larger figure of Elijah Muhammad, but also the tireless work of Malcolm X, the Nation of Islam became the organization it did.
He also was so hardline that if somebody in his family, for example, his brother, strayed from the discipline of the Nation of Islam, he had no sympathy for them whatsoever.
That's true.
Yeah. I think the situation with his brother, was it Reginald? I think it's Reginald's the one who...
Yeah.
Who that's such a strange incident in Malcolm's life, and it's something that I know Manning and I talked about a lot. We were working on the book, the choice he had to make between the Nation and between Reginald, especially because family was at the heart of the Nation of Islam for him in a lot of ways to begin with. There is something that is hard to hold in the mind in some ways about it.
So he recruited a lot of people, became extremely active, as you say, a very charismatic, essentially preacher. And while all this was happening, the civil rights movement was also going on, being led in a totally different way by Martin Luther King. And this raises the question of the differences between the two of them and how to fight racial violence. Do you arm and defend yourselves, as Malcolm was saying? Do you use nonviolence? Which is more effective to get things done? That question seems to be perpetually with us. What was Malcolm's position?
I'm not sure how much these two men were circling around the question about what to do about violence. I think they were circling around the question about what to do about the survival of the black community. Malcolm comes from a much more urban environment, a much lower, poorer class of people. King works mostly in rural areas, I mean, with not the rich, but he also works with the middle class. And Malcolm, as I said earlier, has a much more realistic approach towards the economic hazards facing black Americans and the great chasm between black Americans and white Americans, and not putting any faith in the white community to reach over that chasm and help the black community along. He says, you can't trust them, you can't count on them, they're not going to come through for you, you have to come through for yourself. So I don't think that it's about their relationship to violence, though indeed
They had different answers to
those questions. Malcolm was very dismissive of nonviolence as an ineffective tool in this pursuit.
I think at the end of the day, Malcolm just was principally opposed to nonviolence. He thought it was sort of demeaning. And when he saw, you know, people with hoses turned on them or being attacked by dogs, he felt like the only natural thing to do was to fight back and to defend yourself. And on top of that, I don't think that he believed that King's tactics could really chip away or make a dent at the just deeply sown economic problems that Malcolm was seeing in the cities. And this was, you know, poverty born not just from social problems, but from endemic problems with the system, problems related to government mortgages, problems related to all of these sort of big issues that are spinning out in America at this time, whether it's things like the, you know, the GI Bill or these sort of ways in which the system is creating economic losers.
Where mortgages, redlining neighborhoods so the black families can't get mortgages.
Yeah.
The whole fight over schools.
I've been listening to a whole bunch of his speeches online, and I find myself in this funny position of thinking, here I am, a middle-class person, and yet I agree with what he says, because, I mean,
he's electrifying. Completely electrifying.
Well,
and that's what people found over and over again when they listened to Malcolm, when they met Malcolm. I mean, you know, young, white, college-age students who would consider the enemy in Malcolm's eyes were totally drawn to him and said, you know, they were mesmerized by him. And he, in turn, once the microphone was turned off, was kind and generous and reached out to them as well. I mean, everybody who sat down and had a lunch with Malcolm or who met him, you know, who took him around, who interviewed him, came away entranced by him. He gave new meaning to the word charisma.
How did you find yourself agreeing with him, Mary Charlotte?
Well, I mean, much as you say that this was more about economics than about violence, the sense that the economic system is kept in place by violence, whether that be police violence or Klan violence or whatever, is, I think there's a lot of truth to that. And I think that one responds not only to his charisma, but to that truth. And this idea, I mean, I was thinking, because I love Dr. Martin Luther King, we played, the week of his birthday, we played nothing but Martin Luther King speeches on this show. So hours and hours of Martin Luther King. And I'm listening then to the Malcolm X speeches, which I think I'm going to probably devote some time to playing on this radio program as well, and thinking that in a way, I mean, Dr. King, theologian, is appealing to something that is inside of all of us, which is our spiritual nature, and rising above the kinds of attacks on oneself and one's family and one's community that is basically the story of Black America from the very beginning. And I was thinking Malcolm X appeals to something different, which is, and I don't say this in a negative sense at all, but it's our animal nature. It's the reality of our lives, food, territory, survival, sex. These are the arenas in which oppression is played out. And that's true. And when he talks about that, one viscerally understands what he's saying.
Yeah, no, I would totally agree. I spent, I would have the speeches on almost as, you know, I listened to a ton of them while we were working on the book, but then I would also just put them on as background to just absorb them almost in a different kind of way than, you know, than sort of listening to them for their content. And I think that, you know, like you could say of almost any artist, the form and the content sort of fit with Malcolm, right? There's a, even his way of speaking, the poetry of Malcolm is different than the poetry of King. And it's something that Manning points out in the book, and he makes a very good comparison of their cadences and the way that they talk. And Malcolm has this sort of tumbling street cadence that does, I think, in some ways get at the essence of some of these issues in a way that can't help but sort of strike you. I mean, he brings you to his side.
And it's also linked to a kind of both a deep intellect and a ruthless logic.
Absolutely.
A ruthless logic about the reality of life.
Out.
Yeah.
He traveled, he notoriously would fill a blackboard while he was giving a speech with just diagrams and notes for you to sort of follow along with. He was a dedicated teacher.
How did the followers of Martin Luther King react to Malcolm X and vice versa?
Something would tell me that, a couple things. I feel like we took a call for an interview from a follower of Martin Luther King who didn't seem to have forgiven Malcolm X for his attitude towards King supporters in the last 50 years.
Judging from the phone call we got this morning, I would say not well.
Yeah, judging from that, that's one thing. On the other hand, groups that started out fairly closely affiliated with Martin Luther King, like SNCC, I guess, a Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee. Over the years, these groups grew much closer to Malcolm. You know, by now you have Stokely Carmichael, other people involved in SNCC. They move toward Malcolm, and you start to see the beginnings of Black Power. So it's different. I think different followers of Dr. King responded to Malcolm in different ways. I think those who sort of hewed to that nonviolent approach, that figure, I think they still in some ways maybe see him as misguided. But then I think other people also, especially as the times progressed and the times changed and Vietnam became an issue and everything became more heated, I think other people started to see a little more of what he was talking about.
And they saw Malcolm's prescience for what it was.
Yes.
And I think that's one of the things that people can respond to today, because so many of the problems that Malcolm outlined in 1961 are problems that we still face in 2012.
Exactly. Malcolm X became a target of police and FBI surveillance. Describe this surveillance and why they were doing it. What was the threat that they believed he posed?
Well, I mean, when you look at the list of people that J. Edgar Hoover was spying on in the 1960s, it doesn't seem like it took particularly much to get on their bad side.
I mean, the New York City Police Department thought he was just a threat to public stability.
Exactly.
You know,
they thought
he was a rabble rouser and it was going to cause public riots and burn the houses down.
There's a great quote in the book, an early memo that they wrote about Malcolm X. The FBI wrote about Malcolm X, where they're like, "We can't really get anything on this guy. He's really smart. He's really careful, and we need to figure out a way to control him."
And fascinatingly, one of Manning's great sources was the guy at the New York City Police Department who was basically in charge of tapping Malcolm.
Who was listening to him
the whole time, and through the process of listening to him, becomes converted. It says, you know, wait a minute, this guy actually makes a lot of sense. You know, he's not who we think he is. He's someone else. He may be dangerous, but he makes a lot of sense. And I have to say that being tapped by the FBI is a horrible moral crime and an insult, but it's an incredible boon to archivists and historians because we are able to listen in on Malcolm's conversations.
So you had access to all of that?
Manning finally did, after many, many dogged years of freedom of information.
Some of the stuff, it really was a trickle-out kind of thing. I know there have been little things published over the years of some of Malcolm's files, but, I mean, more the NYPD files, which were, I think, languishing in a box somewhere. I mean, the amount of things that had been hidden, kept away, forgotten that Manning unearthed this book, it's a remarkable amount of material.
So why did Malcolm X break from Elijah Muhammad?
Oof, it's a complicated question, and I guess it has two main answers. I think the first is political, and it has to do with the fact that Malcolm came to believe that separatism wasn't an effective answer to the problems of Black people anymore. I think that he came to see that there was a kind of implausibility to it, and that action was needed, and the kind of action that could redress these problems was action that had to happen within the system. And the Nation of Islam had a very apolitical stance. They didn't want anyone involved in politics. They told their people not to get involved in politics, not to vote, all of these things. And Malcolm just came to think that this was not the way to effect change. It was not the way to improve communities. And so that was something that was trailing along with him and sort of building up steam. The second is a more personal level. I think we talked about earlier, you know, Elijah Muhammad was like a father figure to Malcolm. And when Malcolm became aware that Elijah Muhammad had been having affairs with many of his young secretaries, including one young woman whom Malcolm had almost married as a younger man and who he obviously had special feelings for, there was a tremendous sense of betrayal for him over this. And I think these two things, the political and the personal, are sort of intertwined in causing that break.
Well, not only did he have affairs with them, but he got them pregnant and then abandoned them.
Yes, hardly.
Put it all out there.
Hardly the great apostle of the of the discipline and family values that he was espousing for the rest of the nation. Obviously, the nation also wanted to get rid of Malcolm.
Yeah.
They thought he was a threat. They thought he was too big. He was too big. He was too popular. He was going to eclipse Elijah Muhammad. They were just as happy to see him disappear. And as we talk about the assassination, we talk about a convergence of interests, a convergence between the nation, the New York Police Department, and the FBI, all contributing directly or indirectly their own pieces to creating the circumstances in which Malcolm is gunned down.
On the one hand, one can understand it, but the vengeance with which Elijah Muhammad and the Nation of Islam hated Malcolm X after he left, on the other hand, it seems like such a classic example of divide and conquer, in other words, black on black animosity, that you would think either or both sides would go out of their way to avoid, given the context in which they were living.
You would think, but these were very sectarian times. These were very, very divisive times. And it's, you know, no one knew the future. For all Elijah Muhammad knew, Malcolm was going to put him out of business. You know, they were afraid that the people that Malcolm had brought into the nation were going to then leave the nation with Malcolm. They'd be left with nothing. They're particularly afraid that Muhammad Ali was going to leave, their most visible, most powerful convert. They just couldn't take that risk.
Yeah.
Now, did a lot of people end up leaving the Nation of Islam and following Malcolm X?
No.
No, because the institutions that Malcolm began, there were two organizations, were so embryonic at the time of his death and so ill-defined that they never had a chance to really get their footing.
Not to mention the Nation of Islam spent about 4 months in between the time when Malcolm made the chickens coming home to roost comment and when he actually left, completely vilifying him. They had cut him out of their newspaper. Muhammad Speaks was the official newspaper of the Nation of Islam. They had stopped reporting on him. They were preaching against him, that he had betrayed them, that he was a traitor. I mean, this is a very long and dogged campaign to discredit him among the rank and file, and it definitely had its intended effect when he finally broke away.
Now, after that break, Malcolm X went to Africa and the Middle East, and he embraced what I guess we can call real Islam, and went through another reinvention. How did his ideas change at that time?
I think that's one of the great contributions of Manning's book, is that he had some new and important documentation, i.e. Malcolm's travel diaries from that second trip to Africa. He spent, as Kevin mentioned, he spent 9 of the last 12 months of his life in Africa, and he kept a very, very detailed record of what he was doing, what he was thinking, where he was going. It's an extraordinary document of basically the royalty of Africa at the time, but it puts Malcolm on a trajectory that I call towards a sense of Pan-Africanism, a sense that there were possibilities for the relationships between black Americans and black Africans, that he wants to move, I think as Kevin has said earlier, he wants to move the civil rights movement into a human rights context and globalize it to bring some of these cases into the United Nations, to kind of internationalize this movement.
And I think on top of that, to sort of contribute to that, I think that there was that last reinvention has that component, has that sort of global component to it, but it also has this component. It really is when he formed the two new organizations, especially the OAAU, which is his political organization, and he pretty much comes out and says, "I'll work with anyone." You know, it's he puts that last nail in the coffin of separatism, and it's not this moment where you suddenly think, oh, everything's going to be cheery between white people and black people. It is more a recognition that for the system to change, it's going to take more than the people who do not have power to change it. It's going to take a concerted effort between people who have power and people who do not have power. And Malcolm, I think, came to believe that those problems were going to require a greater energy and more contributors. And it changed his idea of who he was willing to work with, and that, of course, began to change everything else.
How did people in Africa respond to this idea of Pan-African unity and African and African-American unity?
Well, I mean, he certainly was embraced in Africa. I mean, there are many great newspaper articles in Africa that essentially treat Malcolm as a hero when he's traveling through. You know, don't forget, Africa is also at that moment. We're very much in the glow after the sort of colonial reigns have been thrown off. We're talking, you know, 57 through 64, 65. So, I mean, there's a... Do you want to take over, Wendy?
No, I was going to say, they respond to Malcolm as if he is a high diplomatic mission,
yeah.
You know, that he has incredible standing, and they think he can deliver for them more power back in the United States, that they can be recognized, that they can form very powerful relations back in the United States that are going to serve their causes as well.
They're looking for kind of legitimacy.
It's a two-way street.
Yeah.
He also got away from this idea of a kind of capitalist, separatist business idea more toward socialism. What happened there?
We're thinking.
Yeah.
Sorry.
This one doesn't come up as much for some reason. When you get down to the economic unfairness argument, I mean, I think that's sort of at the heart of it. I mean, even Manning talks a lot in the book and say, well, was he, you know, he certainly moved towards or was friendly towards the communists, but was he ever a communist? Not, you know, it's that sort of thing. So, you know, without us putting our foot in our mouth, trying to get into it, I think it all falls under the general category of reinvention and the idea that at the end of his life, he certainly was having, you know, ideas about capitalism, I think, that were different and looking at the kind of economic unfairness that it had wrought. Would you call him a socialist? I think that may be
imputing more, a more sophisticated understanding than he had yet exhibited.
So in the months leading up to his death, he was under continual threat from the Nation of Islam. And certainly those around him said that he should protect himself more, but he really didn't. Why not?
Well, he protected himself a lot until the very day of his assassination. I mean, he had bodyguards. So it's not as if he was walking around making himself a target. You do get a sense of rising doom coming up in him.
Yeah.
And whether it's he had information or whether he just had a, you know, get to smell things building. I mean, it is a very dramatic scene that Manning opens the book with the scene in the Audubon Ball, the assassination being underway in the Audubon Ballroom on February 21st. The guards are called off. The New York City Police Department is called off. You know, their usual patrol. They're usually, you know, a dozen men. There are a few. There are a handful. Something was up.
How much can you take after a certain point? I mean, the book details at least two or three, I think, different assassination attempts. The Nation of Islam beat his men where they found him. They called his house multiple times a day with death
messages. Then they blew it up.
You know, it's like your nerves can only take so much, I think.
Yeah.
And so, you know, even that impulse to protect, I think, can get worn down in a certain way.
And when you've literally been on airplanes for the last 5 years of your life, it's got to be physically exhausted.
So he was assassinated on the 21st of February, 1965, by members of the Nation of Islam. Now, Malcolm X himself had stated his sense that the government was also involved somehow in threatening his life. Is there evidence to support this suspicion of his?
There's no evidence that the government ordered a hit on Malcolm. There's no evidence the New York City Police Department ordered a hit on Malcolm. There's evidence that a mosque in Newark ordered a hit on Malcolm. But the New York City Police Department and the FBI were very happy to see these events unfold. As we say, there was a convergence of interest here. They all wanted him to go away.
There's also the testimony of the police officer, the wiretap police officer for Malcolm, who I don't remember his exact words. They're in the book, and I don't want to misquote him, but it's you know, to the effect of no one was unhappy with the idea.
Which is one of the reasons why they wanted to sew the case up as fast as they could. And so they promptly arrested three men, tried and convicted three men to prison, case closed.
Yeah.
Well, not exactly.
Was justice served or was it not?
Justice was not served.
One-third served.
One-third served. There's very strong evidence, which Manning draws together, that two of the men who spent time in jail for this were nowhere near the Audubon Ballroom that day. And one of Manning's great goals in publishing this book was to reopen the case and to see justice served. And sadly, that has not,
tall order,
as yet transpired.
When he died, what was the response of the mainstream media in America?
Well, it was big news.
They called him a demagogue. It was very much, you know, the preacher of hate. It was probably the most caricatured, oversimplified portrayal of Malcolm that you could find.
And remember, the autobiography hadn't been published yet. The autobiography doesn't come out for a year. And so you got a whole year in which the only record out there is filled with negative stuff. And then the autobiography is published, and the tide begins to turn on Malcolm. The autobiography is unfinished at the time of Malcolm's death. Alex Haley, and I don't think we've talked very much about Alex Haley, his collaborator. Alex Haley is a liberal Nixonian Republican, a black man who's committed to the idea of integration, who's committed to the idea, to kind of most of the ideas that King espouses. So he's had a great relationship with Malcolm over the creating of this book, and they have, I think they've, Manning details great conversations between the two of them. I think they really began to get into each other's heads. However, Haley is left with an opportunity with Malcolm's death. He doesn't have documentation for the last few months of Malcolm's life, and he decides that he's going to spin the end of the tale in a slightly different direction than Manning felt Malcolm's life was going in. And that's where we get this idea of Malcolm spinning towards King. Yeah. That Malcolm's walking towards integration, that there's going to be a kind of embracing, a joining of these two great towering figures in these two movements towards the kind of future for black America that Alex Haley hoped for. He also removes from the manuscript three chapters that Malcolm had written about Malcolm's new social policy and social agenda. So those don't appear in the autobiography. So we're left with a very odd document, but one that clearly was the right time and the right place for it. It became a huge bestseller. As soon as Malcolm died, everybody began grabbing at him and trying to project on him what they wanted. You know, what became the Black Nationalist Movement grabbed him. The integrationist bragged him. Alex Haley grabbed him. Everybody wanted to take Malcolm.
The communists, the Trotskyists,
the NAACP. Everybody wanted their version of Malcolm to be the one that reigned.
And his legacy, despite whatever negativity might have been around at the time, is so vivid, as is Dr. King's in a totally different way, that we still love him, and his words are as important and as, unfortunately, I guess, as current today as they were when he spoke them.
Well, he was a prescient man, but the autobiography of Malcolm X, for all its flaws as an accurate record of a life, is an extraordinary document in American literature.
It's maybe the underpinning of what he's... I mean, it is
a truth. Yeah. There is an unassailable truth about that book, and that I think it should be read by every 16-year-old in America.
And right, or 35-year-old, if you haven't read it.
Or 35-year-old, that it gets at something about the American condition that lives with us today and obviously has very, very strong emotional resonance today.
I love the title of this book, Malcolm X, A Life of Reinvention, because among the many things that Malcolm did and said and was, one of them was that he can't be summed up. He allowed himself to live a complex life, to have complex ideas, and to change. And it's an inspiration, I think, to all of us to allow ourselves our own complexity and our own ability to change.
I think that's
I couldn't agree more.
Really accurate, and I think that's one of the marvelous things about Manning's book is that he doesn't attempt to flatten Malcolm out, and he doesn't attempt to see his life in a linear pattern, that it was just simply one episode after another, and first he was this, then he was that. Malcolm is, like most human beings, a riddle of contradictions, ambiguities, uncertainties, and things that don't seem to go together, but that's what makes him human. And that's what makes him even greater than the saint that people have tried to make him.
We've got a few minutes left. Talk a little bit about the process of witnessing the coming together of this book and working with Manning Marable, the author of Malcolm X, A Life of Reinvention.
Well, Wendy can start this one off, I think.
I've worked with Manning for about 10 years at this point. I mean, Manning is just one of the great men on the planet. We always say it, a twinkle in his eye and a twinkle in his voice. He was a generous, dynamic, tireless soul.
However many years he was into this, I felt like he was still energized by it, as opposed to worn down by it.
He'd call us up and he'd say, oh, guess what I just got? Guess who just came through? You know, yeah. I mean, this would be 7 years and 400 pages later. He was still doing interviews. He was still trying to nail down that last piece of paper. And he, you know, he suffered for many years with a very debilitating lung illness. He was on oxygen for the last couple of years. He had a double lung transplant the August before he died in April. And he came through all of it looking like $1 million and ready to devote what turned out to be every last erg of energy he had to the completion and to his satisfaction of this book.
He approached it like the superb historian he was. I mean, the documentary, the scaffolding of the documentary was an impressive document called The Chronology, which Manning believed that he had to build if he wanted to do Malcolm justice. And this is essentially a chart that looked at every day of Malcolm's life so best that you could understand and document what he was doing on that day. And to build from there, to build from the facts, to the ideas, to the context, and to just build these layers and layers into this book, that was his project, and he succeeded, what we think, so admirably.
The other thing about Manning is that while he was a great scholar and a great teacher, he was also a great activist.
Yes.
And his entire life had been devoted, as had been Malcolm's, to the cause of social justice and to the cause of social justice for the black community. So he could see so much of himself in Malcolm, and he could embrace so much, and he could honor that part of Malcolm. And we like to think that we're honoring that part of Manning in hoping that this book will bring about the kind of arrival at a more just world that they both these men devoted their interrupted lives to.
What's been the response to this book so far?
Overwhelming, I would say.
Yeah.
Incredibly positive. I mean, really, the feedback has been fantastic.
You know, it was an instant national bestseller. It was on the New York Times bestseller list for a number of weeks.
Many bestseller lists.
It was chosen by the New York Times as one of the 10 best books of 2011, as well as on about a dozen other best books of the year list. It was a finalist for the National Book Award. It's currently a finalist for the National Book Critics Award, Critics Circle Award, and a finalist for the Los Angeles Times Book Prize. So it's been honored in every aspect.
Let's not forget the NAACP Image Award.
Well, it was a runner-up for the NAACP Award.
It was a nominee.
However, Harry Belafonte, as we suspected, had a lock on that one. But there we are, the NAACP, the people who hated Malcolm in their lifetime, honoring Malcolm X. So it's been a commercial success, it's been a critical success, but it's also just put Malcolm back on the table again for
conversation, which is exactly what Manning wanted.
Wendy Wolfe and Kevin Doughton are the editors of the book Malcolm X, A Life of Reinvention, published by Penguin. Thank you so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Thanks so much for having us.
Thank you.